At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Emma Southam, the author of a new book, A Rome of One's Own, The Forgotten Women of the Roman Empire, highly recommended, making the Romans as fresh as the 21st century in their ambitions and their retelling of the details. And we now introduce the other side of the coin from Lucretia the Virtuous One, who was celebrated by Augustus and his first century A.D., and passed on to the Julian-Claudian family as the paragon of how a woman should behave. Tullia is the other thing. She is the granddaughter of Tanaquil, that young woman who, with her husband, traveled from the Etruscan city of Tarquinia to Rome as the foundation of the monarchy. But now Tanaquil, Tullia, is more ambitious than her grandmother, although, you know, the acorn doesn't fall very far, etc. And she's married to the wrong man. Emma, this story is extremely believable because of Tullia's wickedness. Do we know what drives Tullia? Did the Romans hear this as just inheritance or something?
They hear this as a kind of almost to them cliched story of female ambition and how women have can go wrong in a very specific way, because Tullia has a sister who's also called Tullia, and they're both married off to their cousins. Each one is married to a man. They're basically married in basis of age. So the oldest Tullia is married to the oldest brother, and the youngest Tullia is married to the younger brother. And they turn out to have fundamentally opposed personalities. So Attalia is very, very ambitious. She very badly wants a public life where people see her as a queen and treat her as a queen. She wants to be in charge and she wants to be worshipped. And the fact that she is married to a man who doesn't want those things, he doesn't want to be king, he doesn't want to try to overthrow his own father, he just wants to live a gentle life. But on the other hand, her brother-in-law very much badly does want to be king. He wants everything that comes with being king, the he wants the fasces and he wants the crown and he wants a big throne. She starts an affair, therefore, with her brother-in-law, which results eventually in them both killing their own partners. So she kills her husband, her brother-in-law kills his wife, her sister, and then they sneak off and secretly get married and start a revolution, and she overthrows her own father. After murdering her sister and her brother-in-law, she overthrows her own father, and that is how she comes to the throne, and how Lucius Tarquinius becomes the king, and it is their son Sextus who assaults Lucretia.
So what we're looking at is the foundation myth told from Lucretia's point of view and Tullia's point of view, remembering that Livy is doing this. Ovid gets involved here as well in telling a story in which the ending will be the success of the Romans to extricate themselves from wickedness. And they will do that by running a revolution. Is that what they think of it? Did they think of it straight?
Yeah. Revolt? So this is considered to be this first overthrowing of Servius is considered to be a coup, an illegitimate overthrowing of people who want power for the sake of power, and proof that monarchy is bad because it breeds these people. When Sextus then rapes Lucretia, this is the sign that the monarchy has become a tyranny, and that now no one is safe from the arrogance and ambition and entitlement, really, of the royal family. But he is terrible because his parents are terrible because his mother is ambitious, and she commits several religious crimes to a certain extent, crimes of a total failure of duty and a polluting crime. She runs over her father's body. She disobeys her father in several ways. She kills him. And then she defiles his body. And that is the crime really that is committed, that is then reproduced in Sextus's assault of Lucretia, and then Lucretia's great virtue cleanses what Tullia has done and kickstarts the revolution that overthrows the monarchy, because Brutus takes her body, shows it as a violated body to the Romans, and they rise up and overthrow the kings and institute the Glorious Republic, which the Romans consider to be their greatest achievement and the most perfect form of government.
And 2,000 years later, we have the same Senate here in the U.S. and the Parliament in the United Kingdom. And what we have here is, again, telling Augustus it's okay to be the boss as long as you don't call yourself a king. And Augustus...
Definitely, yeah.
And that, all of a sudden, Emma, I figured out what Princeps is all about. He wanted to avoid being regarded as a hand tool of Tankiel. He didn't want to have a queen. He didn't want to be somebody who was going to lead a revolt. And Livy and Ovid, they both understand that when they're writing. And Dionysius, he also understands that that must be the way we end this story.
Yes, we understand that always end this story with the restored republic. The republic is glorious. And Augustus says of himself, he wrote his own autobiography called The Res Gestae. And he says, and everybody says about him, he restored the republic and saved it from tyranny. And he has put everything back together and the republic is perfect again. They completely allied the fact that he is essentially in all but name a king, but the glorification of the republic, but the republic centered around a single man. So Brutus then becomes the first consul. He then has a lot of power that he uses, and it is a republic that is centered around a single family, but it is nonetheless a restored republic.
Brutus was a friend of Lucretia's husband, and he played a simple man most of his life until the moment he took charge of avenging Lucretia and establishing the Republic, the 100 senators, the 100 best men. We come now to the religion that sustains all this, that pulls it together, Oppia. Oppia is a Vestal Virgin. This is the 5th century BCE. Where did the Vestals come from? Is that Etruscan?
The Vestals are Etruscan. They're very, very ancient, even by the time that the Romans come around. They are something that exists in, as far as we can tell, all Etruscan cities. And we don't really know what the origin of them is, but they are focused on this incredibly ancient idea of an eternal flame, which is a representation of Vesta, who is one of the big 12 goddesses. In the Greek Olympian pantheon, which is, I think, more familiar to people, she's Hestia. And in the Roman pantheon, she is Vesta. And she is a goddess who embodies the concept of home and the concept of safety. And Vestal Virgins in Rome, they have 6 at all times, whose job it is primarily to tend that eternal flame in the center of Rome, to keep it pure and to keep themselves pure, in order to keep that flame protecting Rome.
And then Oppia falls. And she is no longer chaste, and she must be punished. And the way they do it is especially grotesque, because it integrates the sin, the violation of Vestal, with the wall of the city. How do they kill her?
So they effectively sacrifice her to the gods, but without actually sacrificing her. It's necessary. The way they find out that a Vestal virgin has lost her virginity and stopped being a virgin is generally that something terrible will happen, and there will be signs and omens from the gods. And they need to placate the gods, so they make what is effectively a human sacrifice, but without having to get their own hands dirty, because they don't technically like human sacrifice. So they hold a funeral for her, where they parade her through the city as though she is already a body, and then they take her to a cave that has been dug out just inside the walls of Rome, and they wall her inside that hole in the ground with some milk, some bread, and an oil lamp. And they leave her in there to either suffocate or starve to death, which is a very slow, and very horrible way to kill somebody.
Note here, there's no reason to believe that Oppia did anything wrong.
No,
She was
because the
chosen.
only evidence, the only evidence that she did anything wrong really is that some things start happening around Rome. They've got they've lost some battles. There's been a revolt. Then they start getting omens around Roman territory. You get things like animals talking, and things, strange things falling from the sky, or strange sights and visions that you see, or unusual births are a very common one as well. And then they will hold an investigation to find out what has caused these and which god is upset. And what it comes down to is that the very often that a Vestal virgin has done something wrong. But they're never We tend to read it that the Vestal Virgin has consensually done something wrong, and has had sex, because they are given over to, they're consecrated to this life of being a professional priestess at between the ages of 6 and 10. So they're very young. It's not something that they choose, really. Their parents choose it for them. And so it's often assumed that this is consensual, but there's no actual evidence of that, and we're never very clear what it is that actually happened to them, or if they did anything at all. Later examples of women who are either tried or tried and found guilty are being tried for things like wearing dresses that are too nice, or telling too many jokes, which is considered to be unchaste behavior. And so there's no actual evidence that Oppia ever did anything, just that enough people thought she did.
We must introduce Cicero's opinion of women when we come back. A Rome of one's own, the forgotten women of the Roman Empire. We're in the Republic right now, right at the end of the Republic. Caesar's alive when we come back, and so is Cicero, and so is a very rich woman named Clodia. Emma Southern, the forgotten women of the Roman Empire, a Rome of one's own.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.